Coming up on Philosophy Talk,
risky business.
So, Michael, what's to stop you from doing this?
It's not worth the risk. I got a good job.
What if you didn't have a good job?
Why are some people more willing to take a risk than others?
You've got to act, and you've got to be willing to fail. You've got to be willing to crash and burn.
People take risks all the time.
But are some risks more rational than others?
If you're afraid of failing, you won't get very far.
Do you seek risk or do you avoid risk?
I think both risk aversion and risk seeking are rational, and both to a degree.
Our guest is Lara Bushak, author of Risk and Rationality.
For me, this is a very personal topic. I want to know, what should I do?
Risky business, the business of risk.
Coming up on Philosophy Talk. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're coming to you from the Mars Theater, the Bay Area's breeding ground for new performance.
Our thinking originates at Philosopher's Corner across the bay on the Stanford campus. Ken's a professor there, and I hang around there when I'm not teaching at UC Riverside.
Welcome, everyone, to Philosophy Talk. Today, it's risky business, the business of risk.
Well, Ken, the world is a risky place. All kinds of bad things, nasty things happen. For example, a meteorite could hit my house. Probably not much I can do about that, though, is there?
Well, I guess you could avoid your house, but that wouldn't be rational unless you somehow knew your house was an especially risky place for meteorites falling. But, you know, even so, every time you left the house, you'd still be taking other risks. A bird could poop on your head, or you could get mugged, or you could get in an accident or something.
Okay, so you take a risk whenever you do something without knowing what the result will be. Now, as I recall, there is a widely accepted theory that tells us when it's rational to take a risk. It says that a rational person is someone who maximizes what they call expected utility.
Expected utility. We'll have to talk a lot about that. But let's start by considering skydiving, just to illustrate. You're the agent, okay? You jump out of an airplane. That's your act. Now, there are two possible outcomes. The parachute opens, you glide down to the earth, you have a great time, a memorable experience. Another possible outcome. Your parachute doesn't open. You plummet to the ground. Not such a great time.
Okay, you're off to a good start. You got the act, you got the possible outcomes, two in this case, and you've got the values of those outcomes, at least the ones that you take them to have. But you've left out something important, the probabilities.
The probabilities? How much probability got to do with
Well, that? Let's take your case. Suppose that parachutes in general fail to open once in 10,000 times. So the probability of the fun outcome isn't, unfortunately, 100%. It's only 99.99%. Whereas the probability of the terrible outcome isn't, as you might hope, zero. It's 0.01%.
Hey, you're a real math whiz there, John.
Absolutely. So to get the what they call the expected utility of the act, first, you take the value of each outcome. Okay. Best assign it a number. So let's say the fun outcome's worth 1,000 points, and the terrible one, that's really terrible, death, negative 100,000 points.
Okay, that seems fair.
Okay. Then we multiply each one by the probability of it being the outcome, and then we add them together.
Oh, okay.
And that's the expected utility of the act.
Jeepers, you're trying to say for me to decide whether or not I should jump out of the plane, I need to do that fancy math you just did, to assign all these mathematical values to my options, then do this complicated calculations? Come on, seriously, who does that? Who does that in trying to decide whether to jump out of an airplane?
Well, I usually do, but I realize that for most people like yourself, this would be asking a lot.
Yeah.
But this isn't a theory about what people actually do, but it's just to say if we think there is a rational thing to do, this is a theory that tells us what it is. And maybe you, by the seat of your pants, are really trying to conform to it.
But your theory doesn't even complete. That tells us what you call it, the expected utility of jumping, but to know if it's rational or not, don't I have to compare it with the expected utility of not jumping?
Well, you're exactly right, Ken. To complete the example, we have to figure out what the value of not jumping is and its expected utility. Let's keep it simple. Let's suppose it's negative 25. If you don't jump, everybody will think you're a wimp. Let's suppose that's 100% for sure. So we get a very simple expected utility for not jumping, negative 25. Now, compare negative 25, utility of not jumping, to positive 989.9. That's adding up
what we had before.
It's rational for you to jump and risk your life rather than not jumping.
That can't be right. That can't be right. There's missing something there. There's this expected theory of risk. Seems as if two people don't do the same thing, one of them has got to be irrational. I'm telling you, I'm not jumping. But deciding not to jump, you're saying that's irrational? That's not irrational. I'm just risk averse. You've left something out there.
Well, if I decide to jump and you decide not to jump, we might both be rational, but that would be because we associate different values with the thrill of the successful jump. In other words, the utilities are kind of subjective. I mean, some people enjoy jumping into nothingness more than others. Or some people think it would be worse to die by hitting the ground than others. Or we might disagree about the probabilities. But if we fix the probabilities, maybe through statistics, and we don't both agree that it's rational, then the theory says we must be associating different subjective values.
I think this expected utility theory is missing something. Because can't the difference between you and me just be that I'm risk-averse and you're not? It's not that I think my dying is worse than your dying, or I think a successful jump would be less fun than you do, or the probability difference. I just don't believe in taking that kind of risk. If your story doesn't allow for that kind of difference between us, it's leaving out the crucial thing. It's leaving out the risk aversion.
Maybe it would help if we understood how real people take really big risks, choices that threaten their very lives. We sent our roving philosophical reporter, Caitlin Esch, in search of people who risk everything for adventure, for science, for love. She files this report.
When Karina Holikim is standing at the edge of a cliff about to jump off, she feels, well, I'll let her explain.
It's a fear. It's a natural fear building up inside of me. But I think the difference between most people and I is that I love that feeling.
Karina is a base jumper from Norway, which means she jumps off cliffs, pulls a parachute, hits the ground, and skis the rest.
It's like everything is standing still. And you're on top of everything, and you're in control of everything. And all your senses are broadened and sharpened. And that feeling, it's amazing.
Karina is the first woman to compete in a ski base competition. She says she craved the experience. She kept pushing the envelope, going higher, farther. Then one day, everything changed. She was doing a routine skydive at a paragliding show in Switzerland.
It was considered to be super safe. It was over a lake, over water, you know, what could possibly go wrong?
Karina leapt from the plane and plummeted down. She pulled her parachute, but there was something wrong. It was tangled.
My immediate thought was, you know, I'll fix it. I wasn't supposed to die like that on a routine skydive from a plane.
A split second later, it dawned on her that there was nothing she could do. She thought of all the friends she'd lost exactly this same way. She braced for impact.
And then I hit the ground and it all turned black.
She shattered both her legs. But of course, Karina did wake up. There was searing pain, proof she was alive. And then more darkness. She came to 2 days later. The doctor at her side told her she'd never walk again.
I took that as a challenge and I thought to myself, hey, you know, who are you to tell me what I'm capable or not capable of doing?
In 6 months, she was putting on her own socks. In 3 years, she was walking. In 4, she was skiing again.
One day, I got it back. And when you get it back, you just start appreciating it in a whole different way. And you start seeing the little things that you took for granted.
Risk is something that you have to face in order to live a beautiful and meaningful life.
Zoltan Tokash is a pharmacologist. He travels the world extracting venom from snakes, scorpions, and spiders.
We take back that venom to the lab and research the different ways how the toxins, which are the components of the venom, can be turned into a life-saving medication.
The risks in his line of work are endless. And it's not just from the poisonous critters. Zoltan has been thrown in jail by communist regimes and evacuated from war zones.
Different types of armed conflicts like civil war, drug smugglers, pirates in Panama, Sudan, Yemen, southern Philippines, infectious diseases like malaria and dengue.
But perhaps the greatest risk he faces comes from his own body. Zoltan is actually allergic to snake venom and anti-venom. So get this, he has to worry about the toxicity of the venom, his allergic reaction to the venom, and his allergic reaction to the anti-venom. Zoltan has been bitten 3 times. The last time was in the Brazilian Amazon.
I got bitten by a rear-fanged snake, which is not insignificant for me because after the bite, within a few minutes, I developed a very bad allergic reaction.
He was with 2 colleagues, and they rushed him by boat to the hospital where he was treated, and he survived. But I had to ask, was there ever a time when Zoltan felt the risks weren't worth it?
Well, this was my childhood passion, and I still loved every bit of it. So it's never really crossed my mind that I should quit doing it because it's just too risky. What crossed my mind many times is to better manage the risk.
For Philosophy Talk, I'm Caitlin Esch.
Thanks, Caitlin, for bringing us face to face with basic mysteries about the gene pool. I'm John Perry, along with my fellow philosopher at Stanford, Ken Taylor, and we're coming to you from the Marsh Theater in Berkeley, California.
Our guest today is a professor of philosophy from the UC Berkeley, right over around the corner. She's author of Risk and Rationality. Please welcome to the Philosophy Talk stage, Lara Bushak.
So, Laura, how did you get so interested in risk? Are you a risk taker, a risk avoider, or do you just kind of enjoy doing tricky mathematics with fun examples?
Well, there's this joke about academics that we study the thing that we're worst at. And I think the stereotype in my case holds true. So I'm known among my friends and family as a very slow decision maker. And I think the thing that I find very tricky about decision making is that we often face these circumstances in which we just don't know how our decision will turn out and we don't have all the information. So it's just tricky to know, what should I do? Should I do the thing that might turn out good but might turn out bad? Or should I do the thing that's sort of okay either way? So for me, this is a very personal topic. I want to know, what should I do?
So the interest in risk came first and the tricky mathematics came later. Now, in our opening, I defended a particular theory, the expected utility theory, of how to assess the rationality of a risk. But Ken had his doubts. How about you? Where do you stand on this issue? Is expected utility give us all we need?
Actually, I think that expected utility does not give us all we need. So as you talked about, expected utility theory says that there are 2 things that are up to people. One is how much they value outcomes. For example, how much do you like skydiving? How much do you dislike careening on the rocks to your death? Another thing that's up to the individual is how they believe things will turn out, how they assign probabilities to the different outcomes that could arise from their decisions. But one thing expected utility doesn't let people set is the extent to which they care about the worst case scenario versus the best case scenario. So expected utility theory says everyone has to treat risk in the same way. You just have to take the decision that does best on average.
I want to find something. You said it doesn't allow you to think how much you care about the best case scenario as opposed to the worst case scenario.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that when you say, oh, getting smashed against the rocks, that would be really bad. Like, how bad? Like, really, really super bad. Oh, landing smoothly, that would be good. How good? Oh, pretty good. And doesn't it let you do that? I mean, you assign a value to the outcome, isn't it?
Right. It lets you assign a value to the outcome, but the thing it doesn't let you do is, for example, you might be the kind of person that says, well, it really, really matters to me how things go in the worst case, regardless of how good or bad the outcomes are in the worst case. That's just the thing I care most about. And the fact that it might go better, I don't care about that so much. But you might say, Well, I really care about the possibility of something really good happening. That's what I'm going to concentrate on when I make decisions. So this is a factor that could differ between people, and I argue that it's up to you to set this factor.
So you think, unlike expected utility, just if I get that, we could agree on the probabilities, agree on the values of the outcome, but disagree about whether the risk is worth taking or not, and is it that expected utility can't explain that difference between us?
That's right.
Okay, well, we're going to have to dig into exactly what that means. This is Philosophy Talk, coming to you from the Mars Theater in Berkeley, where we're thinking about risk. Our guest is Lara Bushak from the UC Berkeley.
When is it rational to take a risk? If you get more enjoyment out of driving recklessly than most other people, does that mean it's more rational for you to drive recklessly than it is for others? When have you taken irrational risks?
Risk, reason, and recklessness, along with questions from our non-reckless audience when Philosophy Talk continues.
Thanks to our musical guests, the Playtones. This is Philosophy Talk, and I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor, and our guest is Lara Bushak from the UC Berkeley, and we're thinking about risk.
What's your policy on risk? Nothing ventured, nothing gained, nothing risked, nothing lost? Would you pay $500 for a coin toss that gave you $1,000 for heads and nothing for tails? Join the discussion by stepping up to the microphone in front of the stage. Take a risk.
So, I want to talk about the expected utility analysis of risk. I know you have a different view, but let's get that approach on the table first.
Great. Well, as we mentioned, there are two components that's up to an individual to set: how much you value outcomes and how likely you think various events are. So, for example, if you're unwilling to take the coin flip between zero and $1,000 for $500, you're risk averse. And expected utility theory says, well, there could be two reasons for that. One reason could be that you're really pessimistic. You just think, gosh, the coin is unlikely to come up so that you get the $1,000. Bad things always happen to you. Another reason that you could be risk averse, according to expected utility theory, is that you could just think, well, $1,000, that's not much better than $500. So additional bits of money add less value.
But $500 is, I mean, $1,000 is twice as good as $500, right? If you add it up, okay, sure thing, $500, 50% chance of $1,000 or nothing, seems like they're like, the expected return, as they call it, is equal, right? Because you got twice as good at half the chance. Why shouldn't I just be indifferent between
right, those? So the expected return is the same, but utility is supposed to measure what you care about, how good the thing is for you. So, for example, if you are stuck and you need $500 for a plane fare to get home, but an additional $500 won't get you much more, then $1,000 isn't twice as good for you as $500.
Right. So now, okay, so the expected utility says I'm risk averse if sort of each extra dollar is successively less worth it to me.
Exactly.
Now, it seems sort of right, because, you know, that bet that John offered, if I were risk averse, I'd rather keep my $500 and take the chance of the $1,000. It seems like it's getting at something. You don't think it's getting at the right thing?
I do think it's getting at something. I think it's true that for most people, additional bits of money add less value. But I don't think that can explain all of our risk attitudes. So here's an example in which expected utility theory gives us a conclusion most of us wouldn't want to accept. If you're risk averse in the sense that you wouldn't take a coin flip between losing $100 and gaining $110, and if this is true no matter how much money you start with, then according to expected utility theory, you're committed to declining a coin flip between losing $1,000 and gaining any amount of money whatsoever. So although it seems like thinking about utilities that diminish marginally, which is to say adding bits of money make less utility difference, although that does seem to explain some choices, it seems like if that's the only factor explaining risk aversion, then we're committed to absurd conclusions.
If I wouldn't take this bet that gave me a $10 advantage if it came up heads.
Yes.
It follows from that I wouldn't bet $1,000 in order to get $1 billion?
It follows from that if the only thing going on is that the utility of money declines as you get more of it. So once we see these choices, your coin flip choices, we can infer what your utility function looks like if you're an expected utility maximizer. And this conclusion that you wouldn't be willing to risk $1,000 for any amount of money whatsoever follows from the utility function that we've attributed to you.
I'm not sure Ken gets it, so maybe you need to fill it a little more.
I know one thing. You know, I like ice cream, but I don't like two ice creams twice as much as I like one ice cream. Well, I might like two ice cream twice as much, but the third ice cream, okay, that's, you know. But okay, so you told us what risk aversion is, but what do you think it's missing? I mean, what do you think it's missing?
Well, so expected utility theory says you have to make the decision that will do best on average if you made it over and over again.
Right.
So it has the highest average utility. But a lot of choices we're only making once.
Like that airplane choice.
Hopefully you're alive to make it more than once. But what the theory says then is we should make the choice that would do better if it were repeated over and over again. But most of the time, we're not going to be repeating a choice. So why should it matter which choice would be better over and over again? Since you only have one life to live, it should be up to you whether you want to take the choice that guarantees you something pretty good or whether you want to go for the risk of something.
I'm trying to get my head around this intuitively, you know. Okay, I think of some people as risk seeking.
Mm-hmm.
The skier, the snake guy, risk seeking, right? And I think of some people as risk averse. Like me, I mean, I wouldn't do any of those things. You know, I've never invested in a get-rich-quick scheme. I've always thought of that in the expected utility kind of way. Seems kind of intuitive to me, except I know there's all this work that shows people don't do what the expected utility theory says. So it's like, and then the expected utility people say, oh, people are so irrational. They're so irrational in the handling of risk. Now, I gather you think, not only does the expected utility theory get things wrong about what the nature of risk, it gets things wrong about people's rationality. You think people are more rational in their risk management than all these people are telling us they are. So tell me how you think of risk differently from that.
That's right. So I think it's up to individuals to decide whether they want to make sure things turn out well for them, so how much they value the worst case scenario, how much that counts in their decision making, versus how much they value going after something that's unlikely but that might be really good, so how much they value the best case scenario.
You think risk aversion is a matter of valuing a guaranteed decent outcome, and if you value a guaranteed decent outcome over an unsure great outcome. Mm-hmm. Is that how you would think
of it? That is how I think of it, yes.
So now I'm going to describe something that I'm pretty sure is considered irrational,
okay,
and probably you will too. But so let's say skydiving. That really kind of appeals to me. But I think if I went skydiving, and if the statistics were as we imagine, that every 1,000 times your parachute fails to open, after I'd done it 50 times, I'd call it quits.
Otherwise, attempting fate.
I'd say, I mean, if I do this 1,000 times, then it's, you know, the odds are 50-50 that I'm going to die, at least, something like that. Now, I guess that's irrational because it's the maturation of odds. It doesn't seem to me irrational. Is that still irrational on your theory?
Yes, that is an example of something that's irrational. That's called the gambler's fallacy,
yes,
where you think things are, you know, because a six hasn't come up yet, we're just due for a six. So according to my view, you have to be correct about what the probabilities are, and you have to be correct about what you actually value. But the moving piece is how risk-averse you're allowed to be, how much you can care about what we might call prudence, making sure that things are as good as they can be no matter what, against being venturesome, going after the thing that's really good.
But look, there's a number of different actions.
Mm-hmm.
Admittedly, each jump is as risky as the next, no matter how many you've had previously. But on the other hand, jumping 5 times is riskier than jumping 4 times.
Mm-hmm.
So I can I say, well, I admit that thinking this risk is more likely to result in my death than the four previous ones, just because I've had four previous ones, doesn't make sense. But on the other hand, with this one, I'm deciding to become a five-time jump taker, and that's a risk I don't want to take. Now, am I being irrational as long as I describe it in that way? Isn't it okay? Aren't I perfectly rational?
It depends on what you're caring about in that situation. If you think that you don't want to, you know, you think a five-time jumper would be considered sort of a reckless person, and that's a kind of thing you value not being considered a reckless person, then it could be rational because of what you value. But maybe one thing you're thinking about is the fact that if I, in fact, repeat something over and over again, it becomes less risky or more risky. So maybe in the case of the parachute, I have a guaranteed yes.
So if my grandchild comes to me and says, I want to try skydiving, and you know, since I'm broke, you'll have to pay for it. What do you think? And I said, well, you know, I'll pay for 5 skydives, but no more than that, because I think more than that would be risky. Now, if we decide that ahead of time, it sounds like it's rational, right? If I'm worried about it, it makes more sense for me to pay for only 5 than 6. And yet somehow if we think of this another way, it makes no sense. That's always bothered me.
Yeah, well let me ask you a question kind of related to this. When I used to live in Hyde Park when I was in graduate school.
In Chicago,
right? And now here's the thing. It was an integrated neighborhood surrounded by a black ghetto, okay? And the Caucasian students who had never lived in the city would come into Hyde Park and they'd be terrified. They'd have this sense of, and whenever there was a mugging, which there were or something, people would get really, 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 really worried. And they'd travel all over the show. Now, it turned out that Hyde Park, the University of Chicago, had its own police force in addition to the city police force. It was actually one of the safest parts of town. But anything that happened there gave them this highly elevated sense of danger and risk, and they wouldn't ride the public transportation. They wouldn't walk. And I thought it was kind of racially tinged and all this sort of stuff. But they would do other things that were actually objectively a lot more risky. So what's about that? What do you think? Is that just
right? Another example of that is if you are afraid to fly but not afraid to drive your car the same distance, when in fact driving the car is
much
the more
risky
thing.
Yeah.
So one example of taking irrational risks is just being wrong about the probabilities, being overly pessimistic or overly optimistic. But we also might think certain attitudes towards risk are just irrational because we think, you know, there are these two virtues, being prudent and being venturesome, and we might think the person who only cares about one, so the really prudent person who just stays at home sitting on his couch all day, we might think he's just not responding to the other virtue
he's
at all.
He's too afraid.
He's
too afraid he won't leave, or she won't leave that couch. Now, that's certainly an irrational way of being.
Yeah, I think so, because
why
you're not...
Why is it irrational?
Because you're not... responding to one of the two things that's valuable in decision making. So my point is that there are many different ways to trade these two virtues off, whereas expected utility says there's only one way.
Right.
But this isn't to say that every way of trading these off is going to be okay. The person that's venturesome and not prudent at all is going to be irrational in a certain way.
But the Republicans like to say we need to reward the risk takers. I believe from reading your work and some others that people are mostly risk averse. Isn't that right?
Yes.
Except there's some kind of inconsistency because Kahneman and Tversky and those people showed that we're risk seeking when it comes to losses, but risk-averse when it comes to gains. We don't like to lose our gains. We try to minimize our losses. And they argue that was deeply irrational. Is that deeply irrational?
I do think that's deeply irrational. So I don't want to vindicate all of the tendencies that actual human beings have when it comes to risk-taking. One tendency that's been found is that when we describe choices in different ways, people will make different decisions.
So even though there's the same actual objective
thing. Even though they're the same actual objective thing. So if we describe a choice as a gain, people will be risk averse. If we describe it as a loss, people will be risk seeking. And I think this is paradigmatically irrational because you're valuing the same thing in different ways, just depending on how it's described.
So let me give you a little example, kind of depressing. But suppose we're playing Russian roulette. Right, or I'm playing Russian roulette. So I spin the thing, it's got 6 chambers, there's a bullet in one of them, And every time it doesn't kill me, you give me $5. Pretty dumb.
Yeah.
Pretty dumb. Yeah, even to do it once, pretty dumb. Suppose, though, we add a fact that, like the woman, the Norwegian woman, I just love the fear, the feeling of fear that comes from putting that barrel to my head and not knowing if the chamber has a bullet in it. And then when it clicks, the relief, my God, it's better than I imagine the drugs that I haven't tried would be.
It's like the scene out of The Deer Hunter. You remember the scene out of The Deer Hunter?
I take it that expected utility theory, if those feelings were great enough, could say, well, yeah, it's a rational game for you to play. Is that right?
That's right.
But you seem to be saying, no, I'm going to play the game. Why? Well, do you get a tremendous rush out of it? No, actually, you know, I don't enjoy being afraid any more than anybody else does. How about when it clicks? Is that a real high? No, it's a mild relief. Well, why are you willing to do it then? Well, I just have a very low aversion to risk. So I'm rational, according to Laura Bushock.
Well, like I said, not every way of trading off, caring about the best case scenario against the worst case scenario is going to be rational. And that seems like a case in which we might think, well, you're just failing to respond to prudence at all.
Would you say the same thing about the woman who does the skiing?
gosh, it's hard to know without knowing what her values are, but it seems like there certainly is a permissible range in which people, you know, as long as it's not as if she's doing something that has an 80% chance of death. And it seems like she does get a thrill out of it. So I'm happy saying that that is a rational thing for her to do.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're thinking about the rationality of risk and the nature of risk with Laura Bushock from UC Berkeley.
Would you put your life savings in the hands of an investor who is risk averse? Or would you rather put it in the hands of someone who is risk taking? Would you want your country to court disaster in order to bring democracy to the Middle East? This is a completely neutral question. or would you prefer to play it safe and leave well enough alone?
We're coming to you from the Mars Theater, the Bay Area's breeding ground for a new performance. We'll take some questions from our live audience when Philosophy Talk continues.
Thanks to our live musical guests, the Playtones. I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. Our guest is Laura Bushock, author of Risk and Rationality. We're thinking about the nature of risk. We've got a question from our audience. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, ma'am.
Thanks. My name is Laura from San Francisco. So far, you've been talking about risk in terms of personal risk, right? Mm-hmm. So if I do something, it may have this benefit for me, but also some really awful thing might happen to me. But how do we assess the rationality of risk when it involves other people? For example, let's say I'm thinking of getting into the fracking business, and I think, oh, well, this is a great way for me to make lots of money. Of course, there's a risk that I'll contaminate all the groundwater, and that would be really bad for other people. It's not going to, maybe it'll affect me indirectly, but how do we assess rationality of risks in those kind of scenarios?
Well, there are two ways we might want to think about it. One way to think about it is just that I shouldn't take risks for other people that they wouldn't be willing to impose on themselves. Another way to think about this question is when we think about risk to society could just be thought of as the aggregate of individual risks. So one thing that's interesting is that if we think that people could be more risk averse, so we think people should be allowed to just take the $500 and instead of taking the coin flip between $0 and $1,000, in the aggregate, if everybody just takes the $500, then what we'll have is we'll have more equality and we'll have a higher standard for the minimum person. If everybody were to take that risk, then half of the people would do well, they'd get $1,000, and half of the people would do poorly, they'd get nothing. So as we can see, individual risks aggregated affect the level of inequality in society and affect the minimum well-being.
Well, so you said two different things about, so imposing risk on others and the rationality, irrationality of it, it may be the job of a theory of rationality, but it's probably the job of a theory of ethics and what it's right to do to others. But unless you think like Kant, you're not going to get that out of just a theory of what is risk taking, what's rational risk. You're not going to get that out of that. But the other thing I think you said is really interesting. I mean, if I were a social planner and I wanted to make sure that I distributed risk taking and risk aversiveness, I wouldn't want everybody to be risk averse, right? And you said there's a benefit to people being risk-averse because there's a lot of equality. But isn't there a downside to having too much risk aversion? You don't have the great entrepreneurs and the great capitalism.
The parachute industry.
Yeah. So, I mean, isn't there, in sort of the distribution of risk-taking and risk aversion in a social scale, isn't there like a trade-off? Too much risk aversion is a bad thing, but too little risk-seeking is also a bad thing?
That's right. So just as there is a trade-off on the individual level between my being prudent, making sure the worst case scenario is pretty good, and my being venturesome, making sure the best case scenario is pretty good, then there's also a trade-off between two societal virtues, making sure the worst off people are fairly well off, and making sure there are some people that are really well off and making new discoveries and being entrepreneurs and so forth. So I think that the level of inequality we're willing to tolerate in a society, how much we care about the worst off people versus the best off people, mirrors the level of risk we're willing to tolerate in our own individual decisions.
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, sir.
Thank you. I'm Pete from Berkeley. And my question is, isn't there another factor that you haven't talked about in risk? And that is the factor of time. So for example, if I'm considering whether to start smoking cigarettes, I might have the same probability of getting cancer as somebody else, but I just might not care the fact that I'm going to get cancer many years in the future.
I gotta give you a real-life example. My father is 85 years old, was thinking about giving up smoking his pipe out of fear of getting throat cancer, and a woman said to him, "Look, dude, you've already beat the odds." So what do you think about that?
Good, yeah. So this is another place that people differ. Some people care a lot about how things go for them in the future. Some people don't care as much. And I think that does go into what your value, but I think there's a separate ethical question of how much I ought to care about my future self, how much I ought to care about how things go for me in the future. And you might think, I'm just doing something wrong but it's not wrong in my level of risk-taking, it's wrong in my values if I don't care at all about how things go for me 30 years from now.
We got another question from our live audience.
Thank you. Hi, I'm Mark from Berkeley. And it's fascinating to hear your discussion about utility and the calculations that are involved, because it sounds like actually that's kind of the calculations that happen at the government level as well as our individual level. So just to take your $500 versus $1,000 example, you've got in a situation, for example, with climate change, to move to that level, you've got a $500 ticket in your hand that could give you the option to reduce your cost, not to make money. You may not make $1,000, you put your $500 now, but you put your $500 down now, you may end up paying $850 in 10 years as opposed to $1,500 in 10 years. So how does this question of utility apply to questions of probability when it comes to things like climate change?
Well, that sounds similar to the previous question about how should we think about caring about the future? And, you know, again, this is another element of decision making, and it's going to have to do with what we value, because which risks we're going to take is really dependent on what we value, what we think the likelihoods are, and our attitudes towards risk. But we might think it's ethical to only to make sure we care enough about the future. So there are constraints on what we value just beyond what we value personally. Maybe there are constraints on what we should value.
So in reading your articles, you come to a very interesting conclusion that first struck me as wrong, but now I'm not so sure it does. Usually we say knowledge is power, knowledge is good. The more knowledge you can have about a decision you're going to make, the better. But you say that's not always true. It connects with this risk-taking thing. You think, for example, if you're young and in love and you've been dating for 6 months and you decide to get married, I might say, well, have you looked him or her up on the internet? And you say, well, that might be a really bad idea. How could it be a bad idea? Just see if there's some warrants outstanding or, you know, so forth and so on. So could you just fill us in a little about that interesting aspect of your theory?
Yeah, so that is an upshot of my view that in certain circumstances, it's going to be worse for you from a decision-making point of view to look for more information. Sometimes you should just commit to something rather than look for more information.
Is this now, when you're being a risk taker?
This is taking a risk averse,
sorry,
right?
Yeah, if you're risk averse. This is true. And maybe there are going to also be cases in which you're risk seeking, but here's the risk averse case. And now again, this isn't going to be true in every case, so I'm not saying go out and take a bunch of risks without looking it up first. But in certain circumstances, namely if you already have a lot of evidence, say for the claim that this person would make a really good marriage partner, mm-hmm. and you're about to take a risk on this claim, you're, you know, getting married is a risk. And if the evidence you're considering looking up is not very well correlated with the truth of the thing. So for example, let's say you look her up on the internet and you find out she's been arrested lots of times, so you break up with her and never see her again. But as it turns out, that was just a person with the same name that had been arrested for those offenses. So what's true is that if you already have a lot of good evidence that she's going to be a good marriage partner, then if you're risk averse, you're not going to want to look for more evidence if it has a potential to be misleading.
If I'm the kind of person who has good impulses but seldom acts on them because I'm so worried, then it might be good for me to avoid getting more evidence because the chances are better my impulse is correct than that the
get enough evidence, but then act.
Because you want to make sure that because the risk-averse person is already not inclined to act. More information will make the person even less inclined to act.
Right. And so the risk-averse person requires a higher bar in order to take a risk, and more information has the potential to misleadingly unseat that.
So you're right. So they'll be more of a couch sitter. But see, this is what I don't understand about your view. You're just neutral as opposed to whether people are risk-averse, but it's not clear whether you think they should, as a matter of rationality, be risk-averse. It seems to me that the extreme in risk aversion is sitting on the couch. Right, and that you're gathering more information, and oh my God, all the things that could happen, I'm gonna sit on the couch. That can't be right. It can't be right. I know you say there's a social benefit to equality, but there's gotta be some pressure in rationality to risk seeking, doesn't
it? It's bad for your back, but is it irrational?
Is there any rational pressure to risk seeking as opposed to risk aversion?
So I don't think so. I think either, and you know, we've been focusing on risk aversion, but I think both risk aversion and risk seeking are rational, and both to a degree. So the person, again, who never gets off the couch is not paying enough attention to the virtue of being venturesome.
And the person who never sort of sits back and waits on the couch is like too reckless. Another question from our audience. Welcome to Philosophy Doc, ma'am.
My name is Renata. I'm from Redwood City, and I would like to know if there is a gender difference in being risk-averse or not.
Ooh, that's a good question. I don't think I have the information about that.
Even if you did, it would be risky to talk about it.
Well, I have an intuition. I have an intuition that women are evolved to be the caretakers, the ones who started agriculture while the men were off hunting and blah, blah, blah. I have an intuition that natural selection may have divided the species specialized the species into the risk-taking males and the risk-averse females, and that together they're a really good thing, and either one on their own would be kind of a disaster. See, but I don't know what supports that.
Well, my intuition, which is based more on solid reasoning, is just the opposite. Women inexplicably take a chance and go out with a man, which is a very risky thing to do. Men go out with women, which is seldom very risky. Women get beat up and all sorts of bad things happen. Men occasionally get sued. So the risk risky behavior of women, I think, is the only thing that, I mean, I find it really perplexing.
So you see, my theory makes it possible for people to fall in love.
You want to respond to these untutored intuitions of ours? We're just trading intuitions here. There's not any theory to back, but you have any thought about this kind of issue at all?
I think so. I know that there is some data about this. Unfortunately, I don't know a lot of the data. One other thing that appears to be true is that younger people are more risk-seeking than older people.
Right. So
moods can affect your level of risk-seekingness. So if you're, interestingly enough, if you're in a good mood, that makes you optimistic but risk-averse. And if you're in a bad mood, that tends to... So optimistic in the sense of overestimating probabilities. If you're in a bad mood, you tend to be pessimistic in the sense of overestimating the probability of bad things, but you also tend to be risk-seeking.
So that's like that. That's sort of like that Kahneman-Tversky thing, right? Risk-averse and gains. If you've got gains, you want to consolidate them and not lose them. If you've got losses, you want to minimize them so you take a risk and try it. So it's sort of like that.
The mood thing
switches like that. That's fascinating stuff. I think we're just starting to scratch the surface and get into the deep issues, but unfortunately, I'm going to have to thank you for joining us because we're near the end of our time. So it's been great having you.
Thank you.
Our guest has been Lara Bushak from UC Berkeley, author of Risk and Rationality. So, John, are you having any risky thoughts today, or are you feeling risk-averse?
Well, I don't know. Since reading Lara's work, I've been thinking about, am I risk-averse or risk-taking? And, I can't decide. It seems to me I'm rational, so I don't know.
Well, it seems,
What are you?
I think her view is that rationality doesn't settle risk aversion or risk seeking. That's just an independent variable. That you look at a person's psychology, they're either risk seeking or risk averse, and it's independent, and either can be rational.
I know when you and I go somewhere together and I'm driving, my natural inclination is to say, well, let's try a new way and see if we can get there that way. And you don't like that at all. So maybe we're a little different there.
That's true. Hey, but we both did take a risk on philosophy talk.
That's
right. There you are. This conversation continues at our online community of thinkers, at our blog, Philosopher's Corner, where our motto is cogito ergo blogo, I think, therefore I blog. And you can become a partner in that community by visiting our website, philosophytalk.org.
Now we risk it all for the sake of speed. It's Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher.
Ian Scholes, the bursting of the dot-com bubble brought us down a peg or two, but then the internet morphed into Web 2.0, like a butterfly coming out of a cocoon. This new network of social media enablers is somehow impervious to harm, it seems, as long as we keep faith and we do what it wants us to do. We can't control the internet, we just have to blindfold ourselves, hang on to its long tail and follow. I'm not even exaggerating. Kevin Kelly, founder of Wired Magazine, wrote a book, What Technology Wants, like technology left us a grocery list or something. Jeff Jarvis, the self-appointed internet guru, wrote a book called What Would Google Do, as in the bumper sticker, What Would Jesus Do? The old internet was all about e-commerce. The new internet is all about a different set of buzzwords: transparency, content, singularity, disruption, the blogosphere, branding, listicles. It's all good. If there's a fault, it is ours. We haven't got the right life-work balance. I just heard a newswoman on a chat show say that she struggled with the new media: Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, BuzzFeed, Pinterest, Etsy, Netflix, Huntington Post, Tumblr, and on and on. It was all just too much. Her guest, some guy employed by AOL, actually introduced as an internet guru, told her that his solution was to curate his social media content. He said, quote, I only want to follow the tastemakers. Problem solved. There's a bizarre quasi-mystical undercurrent to the internet that we didn't have when electricity was first corralled or instant pudding. Anytime we get any kind of regulation or even opinion about regulation, copyrights or patents, we get a variation of information wants to be free, which doesn't even make sense. Does information also want a sandwich? A puppy maybe? And if we're supposed to share everything and feel good about it, why are we so upset that we're also sharing it with government spies? They're tastemakers too. If the regulations do stop the internet, what has been stopped? What has the internet given us? The selfie, of course. The cloud, it's not really a crowd, it's a server. If you're out of room in your basement, you can store stuff in the big basement across town. But they call it the cloud because internet. We have Twitter, which lets you make telegrams that anybody can read. This created Twitter revolutions in Iran. How'd that work out? In Egypt, how'd that work out? It called attention to Joseph Kony and his child army in Uganda. How'd that work out? Twitter is worth billions. There's Facebook, which lets you post and read comments to anybody who wants them. That's worth billions. There's Google, which began life as a gigantic phone book. It's worth a gazillion billion and wants to scan all the books, bless its altruistic heart. There's Amazon, Sears Roebuck on steroids, and wants to create drones that will bring goods right to your door. It is working on algorithms that will deliver goods before you even know you want them. Who would stand in the way? Oh, you didn't want that? Of course you did. The internet has read your profile. Pay for it and shut up. It's simple, I guess. The internet is everything that disrupts everything else. Yet the internet itself will never be disrupted. Like the dial phone, the locomotive, the tungsten bulb, the propeller plane, the book, the newspaper. Well, we'll just have to risk it. I gotta go.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Manila Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2014.
Our executive producer is David Demarest. Special thanks to Stephanie Wiseman, Erica Sakalakosheri, and Tyler Hadal.
Thanks also to Dan Brandon and Crystal Nickerson.
The program is produced by the one and only Devin Strolovich. The brilliant Laura McGuire is our director of research. Our marketing director is the smooth and suave Dave Millar. And the artistic and creative Carola Kreitmar is our performance consultant.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University and the partners in our online community of thinkers.
And from the members of KALW, Local Public Radio San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
Not even when they're true and reasonable. The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org, where you too can become a partner in our community of thinkers.
I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.